This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
For many artists, finding a way to earn a living is a proverbial struggle. I met two artists who specialize in expressing their creativity with clay, and they have found divergent ways to make a viable living. Pat Robison in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin, underwrites his creativity via his art school and gallery, where he shows his work as well as works by artisans from around the country. In Cookeville, Tennessee, Marilee Hall maintains a studio, but she primarily sells her creations at art festivals and fairs across America, from San Diego to New England. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join Robison and Hall as they share insights about their creative passion and how they market their craft.
My name is Pat Robison, and I, my wife Karen, are owners of Two Fish Gallery in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin.
Closest to your heart would be the earth, would be clay, would be dirt?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty primary material. We're not going to run out of it, but I've had a love affair with it for almost 50 years now.
It's such a tactile connection with your brain and your spirit and your feelings, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my students are well aware of its therapeutic value, and even for me as a professional artist, it's therapeutic for me. I mean, it's so responsive, it's so sensuous, and I know in my own work, and we talked about this earlier about the mark of the maker, that it's so receptive to the touch that I like to celebrate the marks that it leaves when you work with.
What I find fascinating, other than its literal therapeutic modality, is the fact that you and I could go to Greece and we could dig in the earth and we could find a pot that was 3,000, 4,000 years old, and we could see the fingerprint of the person who made that pot. That's as close as it gets to touching the past.
That certainly is true, Tom. And in my own collection, I mentioned that I had collected crocs as a kid, and I still have in my possession my all-time favorite croc, and it's a simple 2-gallon one with the little, it's got a salt glaze on it, a little number 2 on the side, but what's really magical is it has a dent in it. So someplace, sometime, somewhere, someone bumped that piece, and it recorded like a birthmark on that piece. And that piece continues to be magical to me because it has that energy rather than, you know, most crocs, they were produced part of mass production. But this one just grabbed me. To this day, it's my favorite clay piece.
That's so cool. Isn't that interesting? These little messages in a bottle, yeah.
Well, and I know even in our area in Wisconsin, woodland Indians, and I think in a lot of areas, they would use string or basket material that they would weave into a particular pattern, and then they would imprint that onto the clay, and that is what identified that work as being from their tribe versus having a personal autograph or marking on the piece.
So tribal trademark then.
Sure, and that's how, you know, archaeologically you can kind of separate and designate and be able to get a definitive answer for where a certain civilization was based.
I know it's a little abstract, but dredge through your mind and see if you can share any stories of things like that, of prehistoric, of back-in-the-day clay works that have spoken to you.
I recall back in the 70s, I was doing some archaeological work outside of Manchester, England, and we were excavating a 17th century Roman glassware furnace, and it was pivotal because the furnace was now coal-fired versus wood-fired. So the coal was a hotter fire. It changed the personality and character of the glass. But I remember finding little shards from the clay crucibles that they had melted the glass in. And although they were just little fragments, I couldn't help but have my imagination run with how big were these vessels and what color glass was in them, because there was no residual glass in the crucibles, but I knew that was how they function. So it just
was going on.
What if, you know, you have that kind of interaction, which is, it's invigorating because it's one of those things that you're not thinking about if it's right or wrong or good or bad. You don't assign any kind of value to it. You're just so curious that you're like, wow, I wish I knew more, you know, which is a good hunger to have.
That's so fascinating. Jumping up to modern day, here we are, and you are like the rest of us, an artist trying to find a way to survive and thrive and not get rich, but just pay your way.
Yeah, and that is it's an interesting journey because I make a range of utilitarian and sculptural objects, and my first attraction to clay was I had absolutely no interest in making pots. To this day, I don't think of myself as a potter, although I make many functional objects. But in the real world of doing commerce and supporting a lifestyle, I've come to do a combination of them. And quite honestly, whether it's sculptural and especially if it's functional, I don't really feel the piece is finished until someone like you says, oh, I love the feel of this cup. I'm now going to take it home and it's going to become part of my morning routine. For me, then it's complete. I love making these things, but what would I do if no one was willing to take them home? So, you know, I try to keep them as affordable as it will allow me to keep doing it. And, you know, 20 years in, and in terms of our gallery here, but this is the 46th year I've been playing in the mud, and that is also my floating answer for when people say, well, how long did it take to make this mug? I said, currently 46 years, and I'm a believer that all of our career paths, they're accumulative of all the successes, the failures, all the things we've tried. And, you know, you don't ask a musician, well, how long did it learn to play that song? An hour or 2 hours? No, it's from the time they first picked up an instrument. So that's my current answer for how long did it take to make that.
Well, in addition to you making art, you also teach art. You have a school here. Tell us about that and who would come to it and what you would teach.
What we have in Bat, we live in an arts and crafts style house. We have a gallery on the first floor. We live on the second floor. The gallery is surrounded by gardens, which we display sculpture in. In the back, we have what is a former carriage house, and it's a school building. And so we have classes year-round, adults that many have very little experience, some have more experience, but they come and they have an opportunity to just engage with the material, and we offer just a full program as far as variety of classes. Fortunately, it's been very popular.
Who would come and take the classes? Mostly locals or a lot of summer vacationers too?
We have mostly a local clientele because these classes meet for 6 weeks and they meet for 2.5 hours per session. So it's something where we've had people from as far away as an hour or so that will travel to us for the classes. But as far as visitors coming as tourists, we love to have them visit the gallery and the garden, and we're all about informing them as to how things are made, where they come from, and I wish there was a way for them to have a real experience of working with the material, but it's the kind of thing that requires time to go through the process. You make things that need to be dried and fired one or two times, and so it's not easily facilitated on, say, a weekend. But maybe I'll have this epiphany one day and say, here's how I can do that. Because I know there are opportunities for people to just come in and, as they say, paint or glaze an existing object. But I think the real magic is in handling the material and making the object.
Back to your gallery, you show other artists' work here as well as your own.
Yes, 20 years ago, we started with about a dozen artists who I had either taught with or gone to school with or exhibited with. And now we typically have 65 or so artists from across the country. They include anything from sculpture right on out to jewelry and glass and leather and wood. So there's a variety of medium and artists that we represent. We also work with 9 different fair trade organizations. So we bring in fine craft from around the world, which we qualify by making sure that it is fair trade and that the artisans who make it elsewhere, like ourselves, get compensated for their effort. That, along with one of our galleries, has changing exhibitions. So a lot of local artists will enter juried shows here, and we will display and sell their work too.
And where are you located?
We are located in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. That's about an hour's drive north of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is my hometown.
For further information.
Okay, again, my name is Pat Robison. My wife, Karen, and I own the Two Fish Gallery, and you can learn more about us on our website, which is TWOFISHGALLERY.net. So remember, it's twofishgallery.net. Just connect fish with net.
There you go. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing. What a wonderful morning.
My pleasure. I'm glad you were able to join us this morning.
It was really great. Mary Lee Hall. We're in Cookeville, Tennessee.
That's correct.
You have managed to find a way to make a living and survive as an artist. That's pretty cool.
Well, I feel very fortunate. It's been a lot of work and a lot of traveling and many, many friends. It's been a good career.
You're tucked away in an alley on a side street downtown. So people have to seek you out. It's not a drive-by destination.
It is not. However, people do find me. I'm not technically open as in a gallery.
Like retail hours. Or...
Right, but I am happy to sell anything in here. I know that I'm a destination for when people have out-of-town guests, and so I have lots of folks coming through. It's just wonderful fun, and I'm in an annual art show.
I was going to say that you go outside and do shows around the state, around the region, right?
Oh, around the country. Mm-hmm. I have done many, many shows, and from as far west as San Diego, and as far north as Boston, and as far south as Key West.
I'll keep you busy.
Like many people in my medium, I throw it all in the van and drive. There's no flying.
Talk to us about what you do. Why do you do what you do? You literally are expressing yourself in a very figurative, tangible way. You're telling a story. And how is it metaphorical for you?
I think that if it were not clay, I would be telling a story in another way. I'm very connected to people, and I interact with people just with glee. And I feel like it's really important to laugh. And I have lots and lots of fun with folks. And I,
as you had mentioned earlier about somebody else, the first thing that happened to me when I came in was I smiled. And then that whimsy just permeated everything you do. Tell us about that aspect.
I think that I'm here to help people realize that they're closer than they think, and to help people, individuals, and to help people love each other. It's just a miracle that I kind of came across this medium. What happens for me is I just sit down and start making things, and it just depends on what my mood is, what's coming out.
So you don't even know what's going to happen when you sit down.
Well, it's better to plan something, and very often it does not turn out that way, but if you plan something, that creates an opening for what is going to emerge to do so.
Give us a tangible example and maybe a shifting in gears as you started making something what you thought it was and why it changed and how it evolved.
Okay, say for example, I started making the figure of a woman. And she was going to be a regular woman. And then her arms seemed to want to bend up instead of hang down by her body. And so once her arms were up, I felt like I needed to put like a bird in one hand and a bumblebee in the other hand. And then, okay, there she sat, and I thought, well, this is something that's happening here. And so I began to make other creatures that she perhaps had manifested of her own volition.
For the listener, roughly scale, size.
This project I'm talking about was probably about under 2 feet tall, and there were lots of characters, and there ended up being a tree and a mountain and a rabbit, other animals, and this woman, you know, created a whole earthscape for her to stand on. She became like a deity for me, and it was like a creation story. And sometimes the things just shift a little bit, and so maybe something, I'll put legs under something that I wasn't going to, and it becomes taller, and it has voice.
Talk to us a little bit about some of the characters that we see right here around and why.
Well, I was telling you earlier that I have a series which was started in 2008 when we had the economic downturn. And I had been enjoying making figures. However, the bottom kind of dropped out of my market, and I thought, okay, I've got to do something. And I want to continue to make these happy, loving figures, and I want to call them something else. And how can they relate to people? And I decided to make wedding cake toppers. And so I began to make figures that were brides and grooms with various personalities. And I offered those on commission. And so people began to order them for me. And I would make them, and I would put the outfit that the bride and the groom are wearing, and I would also feature their dogs and cats, their children by our first marriage, or the kind of fruit that they like to grow, to make them very, very personal. And then once the wedding is over, they save these sculptures and just remember how lucky they are to be together.
Right in front of us, we have a whole different world, a world of shrines.
Yes, we have shrines. I have several shelves here that contain prototypes for workshops that I have taught. And Shrines was a really popular workshop, and because it's important to honor things in our lives. And by creating these wonderful little shrines, little buildings that are little, they're like stables, then people can take them home and feature things that give them joy. And so those are really fun, and doing them all together is wonderful fun for us.
Right now, I feel like I'm back in elementary school. We're sitting at
these tiny chairs.
Yeah, and there are two rows of tables, and right in front of us, there are works of art all lined up. And I understand that this is a special thing because it has to do with Habitat for Humanity.
It does. There are some very special people here who started the Habitat for Humanity's Cooking on the Square. And I imagine it happens in other cities, but this one is very successful. Artists from the Appalachian Center for Craft and all the clay artists around here, whether they are amateurs or professionals, make bowls, make many, many bowls. And I have made a very few, but I'm planning to glaze these and donate them.
You're going to have some people come in and help you, right?
Yes, I will have beer. If anybody,
an incentive.
That's what I call it. Yes. And so, and then we'll donate those, and then people will buy those and get all the gumbo they want and Cajun music, and we will donate all the funds to Habitat.
Well, only because my bus is leaving.
No.
Yeah. I have to say goodbye. But it was so cool to meet you.
Thank
and
you.
I'd love to come back and sit down for a whole class.
That's
and
right.
Get my hands into the clay.
Come and do it, and we'll have beer.
I love it. One of the four food groups.
That's correct. Nice to meet you. Thank you for coming.
You're very welcome. We've been visiting with Marilee Howell, who's a ceramic artist in Cookeville, Tennessee. We'll see you here.
Marilee Hall Ceramics, MARILEE.com.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Cookeville, Tennessee. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.